Some compelling but difficult stories on your radio today. The devastation of abuse, the importance of having someone to listen, and antisocial child gangs. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
And she said to me, "Karen, I'm sorry I didn't look after you as a little girl. That all I want for you is to be happy." And 4 days later, on the June bank holiday Monday, my mum was taken out of a canal. And my mum was gone. My mum was dead.
We might be bored of the virus, but the virus is not bored of us.
And they circled me, hit me several times. They grabbed the rubbish bag, smashed it on my head. One had a little dog and tried to get the dog to bite me.
And we'll start here on the Ray Darcy Show, and just some excerpts from Ray's powerful interview with Karen Leach, a survivor of abuser Derry O'Rourke.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, it was actually on a Monday as well, Gary O'Toole joined us in studio to talk about the role he played in exposing the horror of former coach George Gibney's sexual abuse of swimmers in the 80s in Ireland. George Gibney, while never convicted, was not the only coach in Ireland at the time who was carrying out such barbaric crimes. Derry O'Rourke was sentenced to 12 years in 1998 for sexual assault, indecent assault and statutory rape of children. Between the ages of 10 and 17, Karen Leach was abused by Derry O'Rourke, her coach at the time. And since the publication of her story in the book Deep Deception, Ireland Swimming Scandals, Karen has been speaking out across Europe and advocating on behalf of children and young people. And she joins me now in studio. Good afternoon, Karen.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You're often in my thoughts because we hear a lot these days about triggers.
Yeah.
And people have to give warnings before TV programmes, before radio interviews about triggers. But oftentimes, I would imagine, you come upon things that are triggers and without warning.
Yeah, yeah, I do, because it's the reality of what's going on now in the world. You know, there's abuse in sport, and it's more and more, there's more athletes, more young people coming forward and sharing and talking and asking for help.
Yeah.
And I will be very involved in that work in Europe and across the world and in the UK. I find myself now, you know, I have a lot of young athletes and athletes that have retired contacting me in relation to what's happened to them and what is happening to them.
Right.
You know, and they're reaching out and asking for support and help.
And this is always tough, but we have to remind people about your story. So you were swimming in King's Hospital Swimming Club.
That's right, yeah.
You were picked out as somebody with potential.
That's right, yeah. Derry O'Rourke, he saw me swimming in the community games and saw me with great potential and started to headhunt me and call mum and dad for me to join his club, the King's Hospital.
And that was the beginning of his grooming of you and your family.
100% right. And my family. I'm glad you said that, because it wasn't just me. He that's where it started. He knew exactly what he wanted to do. And he had started even before I got to his swimming club.
And in speaking to Paul Stewart, who featured on that documentary last week, Football's Darkest Secrets, the stories are so similar.
Yeah.
And of course, there's flattery involved, isn't there? Your daughter could be an Olympian.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
yeah.
I'm like, what happens then? You lose all logical thought, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, I mean, I had a dream as a little girl. And my dream was to go to the Olympics and swim for Ireland. And I loved swimming. And now you have an Irish Olympic coach who's seen you swimming in the local community games, knows your dream and starts, you know, encouraging and saying and phoning your parents and saying, you know, I'm the Olympic coach. She's great potential. Let her come to my club. I'll get her there. I'll develop her. I'm the best. I know what to do and the right training. And that's what he had started on the phone. I mean, we didn't have mobile phones back then.
Yeah.
And I remember the phone in the kitchen, because that's where we had our phone ringing, and dad would be speaking with them. And he kept calling.
Yes.
Until eventually I went there.
And Ray asked Karen about her parents' sense of guilt in not knowing what was going on.
You know, my dad used to say, you know, Karen, mum's dead and I took you there. And that was it. You know, dad, they were never away from me. They were there all the time. And one of the most important things I really want to share and say to parents is, please do not just leave your children there. And if you're told to go away and come back or sit in the car park, and we look after your children, please do not do it.
Yeah.
My dad was told that, Ray, and mum, and they did what they were told. My dad slept in the car every morning on the other side of the wall of the changing room of that swimming pool, and I was being abused sexually, mentally, emotionally and physically while he was asleep in his car on the other side of the wall for me. He was so close. He was so close. But yet he couldn't save me because he didn't know.
Yeah.
He was doing what he was told. He was honouring that club and the rules and that coach and told to stay out.
And this is the thing that people fail to understand again and again. They can't see how somebody like Derry O'Rourke can command such authority over people.
Yeah.
But these people, they have, I suppose, they have talents, don't they? Because he was a very good coach, as was George Gibney.
Yeah.
They're charismatic people. Mm. They're charming people, because without these skills and these talents, they wouldn't be able to do what they do.
Absolutely. And you know, they know exactly what they're doing. And there's not just George Gibney and Derry O'Rourke. There's hundreds, thousands of them out there. And in particular, sport is a great place for these people to go to because easy access to children.
Yeah.
But they know exactly what they're doing. And more than, you know, nearly all, you know, they're pillars of the community, their family. I mean, Derry O'Rourke had a family. His children were in the pool. His daughters were in the changing rooms with us. You know, that they get on with everybody. They know. They're pulling everybody in. They know exactly what they're doing in order to get to children and to be seen as, and to put themselves in a position of power and control, not only with children and young people, athletes, but with parents, with all the other athletes that are around them.
And Karen spoke about living in silence about the abuse.
I don't recall, and I don't ever remember him telling me not to tell anyone. And I didn't. We didn't even tell each other. The other girls that were in the changing room. The first time that I knew of what was happening to any of the other girls was, I remember one particular incident when we went to the Dublin forecourts, and I walked in and I saw one of my friends who I was very close to at that time as a little girl, and she was standing across the in the room, and I looked over, and that was the first time.
This was years after.
This was in the Dublin forecourts in at the court case, years and years after. So the silence, you know, I knew you did what you were told. You had to be the good girl. And even sometimes if you weren't, and when I say the good girl, meaning doing all the proper training, achieving the times he was setting for you, doing everything he told you to do, you know, the proper kick, the proper technique, everything. And you would try your best to do all of that. But even if you didn't do all of that, you could still get called and pulled, and he'd have something to say to you. So I had seen him move swimmers out of, you know, senior A's into senior B's or out of the club altogether.
Why do you think that happened?
Well, I mean, it's only in years later speaking or, you know, seeing it from as a woman's point of view and looking back on it. You know, if you didn't do what you were told to do, you were gone. And if you didn't do what he wanted, you were gone. And that was it. But in my mind, even as a little girl, I knew that. I knew that if I didn't do everything that was required of me to stay on that team, that I was gone. And then my dream was gone.
Yes.
My life, my swimming, everything was gone. You know,
he had so much power, so much 100%. Power over you. I read somewhere that Michelle Smith said that she, because Derry O'Rourke was her coach.
Yeah, I swam with Michelle for all those years. We were great friends.
And she felt that he didn't like her or whatever, because he had tried his hypnosis and his measuring of fat, etc., with her, and she had told him to go take a hike.
Yeah.
And now she knows, as a woman looking back, that what had happened was that because he knew it was a no-go area, so to speak, terrible expression, that he, you know, that was it. She was gone from him.
And Karen spoke about going to court.
You were sitting at home listening to an interview on the Pat Kenny Show.
Yeah.
In 1998, after he had been found guilty of a number of cases of sexual abuse on minors. And you had that moment, that horrible moment where you go, that was me too. And then you and others came forward as a result of the reporting of that case, and he went to court again.
That's right.
But he didn't get any extra time in prison.
No. No, he didn't. All concurrent. And, you know, at that time, I was just lost. I hadn't a clue. Didn't understand any of that system. It was horrific, is all I can say. I remember being in the forecourts, and the detectives had said, you know, not to look at him, that he was trying to make eye contact with us, that he was one of the most cunning paedophiles that they had ever worked with. And I remember standing there, and my brother came with me. I didn't want mum and dad to come because I didn't want them to know. It's one of my regrets. Yeah, I thought I was protecting mum and dad by not letting them come. But my brother came with me, and when the doors opened and he walked in, and he had handcuffs. So he was with prison officers. And I mean, at that time, he went in the front door and it was the big circle in the forecourts. And next thing, he was standing there. And even though he was in handcuffs, oh my God, my legs went from under me, and my brother had to hold me up. And I was petrified. I ran downstairs to the toilets downstairs, and I locked myself in the toilet. And I curled up on the floor, in behind the toilets, and I was never coming out because he was there. And I mean, I was a grown woman. So it was horrific, that going through that system.
It's a living nightmare.
And it still is.
It still is. Yeah. That's the, I'm sorry. That's the...
Yeah.
Yeah. And just to go back to Paul Stewart, because we did speak to him and he featured heavily in Football's Darkest Secrets. And he describes telling his parents as the worst day of his life, despite the fact that he'd been sexually abused for, I think 4 years. I can't remember the exact amount of time. But he described that day when he had to go and tell his parents as the worst.
Yeah. And, you know, I 100% agree. The most frightening thing and most harmless thing in my whole life was telling mum and dad. I mean, it took years for me to actually tell myself, to acknowledge it myself. And I told my mum first, and I asked mum to tell dad because I couldn't tell dad. And it was just devastation. And from that moment on, really, of telling and saying what happened to me, the hell that I was living in before became an utter, utter. Just everything in my life went wrong after that, and has taken me years and years to recover from that point of sharing and telling my parents and my brothers.
And part of your recovery has been talking to people and talking to organisations and trying to ensure that this doesn't happen to other children.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. And that's hugely important in your recovery, isn't it? And the horrific thing that happened then was that your mother took her own life.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
And it was directly as a result of,
I suppose after that court case, the reality really, really hit me. All of a sudden, it's like, oh my God, this is true. And I know that might sound crazy, but it was actually the reality of everything that I thought and memories and what my body and everything was remembering. It's true. And it took me, I just went off the rails. And I suppose I started, many suicide attempts started, and I would have ended up in hospital. I ended up in psychiatric hospital, St. John of God's Hospital, and I was just, I had a total nervous breakdown. I couldn't cope. I couldn't live with what had happened to me. And mum and dad, even over the years before they even knew, they wondered because I was off the rails, let's say, even as, you know, a young girl and in my 20s and 30s. So they had asked me and I kept saying no, no, no. And then I suppose one Thursday, I mean, having a conversation, I had just been let out of St. John of God's, and I was sitting with mum and we were having a conversation, and she said to me, "Karen, I'm sorry I didn't look after you as a little girl. That all I want for you is to be happy." And 4 days later, on the June bank holiday Monday, my mum was taken out of a canal and my mum was gone. My mum was dead. And for years and years and years, I thought it was my fault because I shouldn't have told anyone.
No, it wasn't your fault. You know that now. Of course you know that.
But for a long time, Ray, you know, that stayed with me. It's only the past couple of years I've been able to understand that it wasn't, because the devastation that that brought to dad and to my brothers and to our family, the hurt and pain.
That's just a bit of Karen Leach's interview on the Ray Darcy Show. And if you need to talk about anything, the number of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre is 1800 77 8888. That's 1800 77 8888. And in the afternoon, Liveline. Now, last week, after Joe got a call from a woman who said she had a bad experience of verbal abuse from a group of preteens in a Dublin park, Jo got more and more calls about antisocial and racist behaviour from children in gangs. So Joy Matthews called Jo.
So Joy Matthews, I know the locals who you speak very highly of call you Matthew. So Matthew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joy. Good afternoon.
Tell us what happened last Thursday. We've seen the videos. We're going to try and get them out past the lunatic GDPR because these guys are committing horrific crime. What happened, Matthew?
Thursday evening, around 6:30, the gangs, the group of youngs, they're gathering together around this area. Mm-hmm. And a few of them, not in front of the shop, they are near the shop. There is a small park. They're gathering together and come into the shop around 15-20 kids all together and come into the shop and take the things, the ice creams, jellies, chocolates, and all those things. They grab the things and they start to throwing this to the staff. Even though one of them in the till and they're throwing to the things to the staff. Hmm. And then immediately one of the staff came and he pulled down the shutter.
Yeah, and we see that. In between that time,
they went outside and throwing again and into the shop. And there is ice creams and I don't know, there is maybe a few stones or something. One of my staff was little hurt or injured his finger.
Okay, yeah. we'll try and, as I say, we'll try and pixelate the video, but because they're obviously committing a crime, they swarm into the shop, about 15 or 20 of them in their tracksuits. We counted at one stage 13 teenagers running into the shops.
Exactly.
They basically rampage around the shop, grabbing whatever they want and not bothered. One of them was actually videoing himself, I presume, for Snapchat.
there is many of them outside the videos. There is a few cameras outside the shops.
Crazy. That's
how more videos I have, the more videos.
Yeah, and then you have video of them gathering outside. And they just run in and like rats, overtake the shop, grab whatever they want and start throwing some of the product at you and your staff. And then they nonchalantly, 13 of them leave the shop. They obviously feel they're totally immune from the Gardaí. And then they start attacking. When you and your colleagues run out to try and, I presume, retrieve some of your stolen product, they start lobbing some of the products they've stolen back at you and trying to attack you, and you have to pull down the shutters.
So Joy Matthews there. Then Mina Choi told her story.
Tell us, you were attacked by a gang of teenagers as well. When did it happen, Mina?
It happened last Tuesday, March 23rd, about 9:50 p.m. I was walking back from, I think it's Talbot Street, the extension of Henry Street beyond O'Connell.
Yeah, Talbot
and Street. And just after I passed the spire, I saw 10 or 12 lads. I would have guessed they were between 15 to 17 years of age. Mm-hmm. They were spread out across Henry, so you couldn't actually pass without going through some of them.
Yeah.
And they said something and I might have talked back to them, and they circled me, hit me several times on the back. They grabbed the rubbish bag, smashed it on my head in the back.
Nice.
They threw another rubbish bag. I think I managed to knock it down. Luckily, I had a walking stick, so I sort of swung it around so that they couldn't come towards me at the beginning. I mean, in front of me, and then they just they circled me, hit me in the back. Some of them took videos with their mobile phone. One had a little dog and tried to get the dog to bite me. One of them was on a scooter. I don't know why they ran off. I mean, it was really, really scared. Had they stayed another 10 minutes, maybe I would have been on the ground bleeding. But they ran off. And then they took a left and went north on O'Connell Street. And then I was shaken and I walked away. And then I realized I better call the guards.
Okay.
And I did.
And they actually physically hit you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, my back was stinging from where they hit me. My arm was stinging. My head. And I found out later they must have kicked me because my right ankle was swollen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're in a melee and you're trying to defend yourself against 10, 12 boys circling you and tossing things at you, heckling you, saying terrible things like, I don't know if I can say it on air, but you can bleep me, you know, calling you a fucking chink, hissing and saying Chinese several times, hissing at you. You're doing your best to, just defend yourself. I'm a woman on my own. What can I do against 10, 12 boys circling me right on Henry Street, just by the spire?
And Henry Street is a busy street. Did anyone come to help Mina?
No. That was actually really disappointing. There must have been at least 10, 12 people who must have seen it, because I can't believe. And that's the reason I use that street, because it's very well lit.
Yeah.
It's very wide.
Yeah.
And I usually walk in the middle. That way, so I'm sure there were people, and nobody came to my aid. Oh, so gosh. I had to grab. I grabbed the woman and asked her to help, but she moved on.
Okay.
I grabbed us. There was a sanitation truck with three men, and I said, "Can you stay with me until I call the guards? Mm-hmm. Because I'm afraid the lads will come back." They said, "I'm working and I don't speak English." So they moved on. And then I grabbed another couple. They were pushing their bicycles. And so I said, "Can you please stay with me? I need to call the guards. And I'm just afraid they'll come back and attack me again." And they did. And the guards came about 20 minutes later.
Yeah. What age were they, do you think?
I can only guess. But I would say anywhere from 14 to 17, just from the look. Yeah.
And when the guard, I don't name any guardie, but when the guardie came, what did they say?
I personally felt that she was quite unhelpful. She told me how if they're under 18, it's going to be impossible to bring them to justice. She talked about the J-Lo system. I didn't understand what that was.
Juvenile liaison system. Yeah, yeah.
And that there's no point. She kept asking me. So I felt like she was really asking me, do I even want to file? And I said, you know, there were 10, 12 lads, they hit me, they attacked me. If I didn't have a walking stick and I was able to swing it around just to get them not, maybe it would have been worse. I'm traumatized. And I said, look, you can see the garbage bags, they were bright green ones in the middle of the, on Henry Street, just before the spire. I said, you can see what they tossed at me. There was no effort to take a photo of the evidence. There was no effort. And then she asked me to come back the next night at 7 p.m. to the station, so which scared me even more. So I had to get two friends to escort me, because I thought, oh, great, now, at 7 p.m., I'm now really scared. So, and the same thing happened at the station. She said, "Are you sure you were hit?" And I said, "Yes, I was hit. Like, why would I make this up?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "I think they're very difficult to identify." I said, "You know what? This is not the first time I run into them. I think if you station somebody on Henry Street on a night that's not, when it's not raining, you will definitely see them coming down. It's almost the same route they took the previous time I ran into them, which is they go down Henry Street towards O'Connell. When they hit O'Connell, they make a left up towards the GPO, I guess. So the whole thing has just upset me very much."
Well, that's Mina there. Then John called Joe after he was attacked three times by teenagers.
The first time it was like just bottles of water being thrown at my body, like small bottles but full of water, and one hit the back of my shoulders, which was bad enough. I did report that now to the Gardaí, and the Gardaí came out and said, "Oh yeah, this is a quite a common thing in this small town there. They stand at the bus stop and they just wait if you're a bit vulnerable, and they wait till you go by and then they start to throw it." The second time, I was on my bicycle the second time, again coming out of the local supermarket, and they had just, as I was putting the groceries on, they kind of came up and, that kind of thing of shocking you, rattling the handle back. And again, but when it happens to you, the three or four gather around you, it's like very shocking. But the last time was last week, and I wasn't going to do anything about it until I heard that woman of the you know, the Chinese story, on Henry Street, and that really provoked me to call you, Joe. But what it was, about half five, completely broad daylight, I'd come out and I had two heavy bags on this old bicycle. It's a good old bicycle around the town. Put the two bags on, and I had left the supermarket to join the main road, as I usually do, nice and slow coming down. I saw them bouncing a ball, and I just thought, oh, here we go now. That ball, I say, that's going to be for me, you know? They kicked the ball at the bike sign, so that was a weapon. Obviously, I had to stop then, and the bike would tint, and that's when the three or four of them kind of came up, and within an instant, Joe, they just took one of the bags, I think it was on the one on the left-hand side, full of groceries, and just threw it into the opposite ditch.
Just brazen again. Now, brazen.
Get on with you. Now, at that point, I didn't even look. I wasn't going to, because I know the crowd. You know what I mean? They seem to have disappeared for a good while, but now it just seems that the game is back on.
And what age group again, John?
This is all, from about 12 to 18, if you want to call it that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Some on bikes, some not on bikes, you know?
Okay. And
but I just carried on then and went home. But again, I should phone in out after hearing the Chinese one. I just thought, no, I mean, you know, we have to.
Now the Gardaí, what I understand is the Gardaí is saying, or the CSO are saying, that serious crime is down 1/3 during the pandemic, which is brilliant and is primarily due to the work of the Gardaí against the gangs. Incredible work. But that level of crime that we're talking about has a serious effect on people, and especially when there's a gang of them, as in Matthew's case, as in Mina's case, and as in your case, John, and as in the cases over the last 10 days we've heard on Liveline.
That's John on the Liveline with Joe Duffy. Now, Barcelona on Saturday night. A music concert, people dancing, singing, and generally having a rocking good night out. You'd almost forget we're in the middle of a pandemic. Journalist Sarah Morris was telling Claire Byrne in the morning about Spain's pilot to bring back the nightlife.
Looking at these extraordinary pictures from this concert on Saturday night, and it was all facilitated by the Spanish health authorities. Why and how was it allowed to go ahead?
Yes, well, as you said, really a slice of almost pre-COVID life. But there were some conditions for those concert goers. Basically, doctors were involved in testing those concert goers. Everybody, for the price of their ticket, got one of those antigen tests, which they had to take at one of three venues on the day, Saturday, of the concert. Once they had received that test, they were sent the result to their mobile phone. About six people tested positive, exactly six tested positive, and weren't allowed to go to the concert. They got a full refund. Another person was found to have had a close COVID contact and was also told they wouldn't be allowed into the concert. But the rest were given a special one of those FFP2 masks, the white masks, which they had to swap for their own. So they had a clean mask to go into the concert. They had to keep the masks on during the concert, but they were allowed to dance pretty up close and personal, to sing along to Love of Lesbian, which is a Spanish indie band which was giving the concert. They weren't allowed to drink any drinks inside the concert venue, but there were bars set up just outside the venue, and there was special ventilation. But as you say, looked very much like a scene of pre-pandemic life.
And Spain, of course, has suffered horribly during the pandemic, Sarah. So how was the concert viewed by the wider Spanish public? How was it received?
Well, there's a lot of excitement from young people and from concert goers and people who work in the music industry. They really feel this is a route back to holding mass events, and that if they're proved to be safe, because these people will be tested in 14 days to see if they have the virus or could have caught it at the concert, but they see it as a route back to organising some kind of events. And they point out that back in December there was an initial pilot with fewer people, but 500 people went into a concert. Another 500 people acted as a control group, and of all the 500 people people who were allowed at that December concert, they were all tested 8 days later. None of them caught the virus at the concert, and the control group had 3 people. So the organisers were saying, you're as safe in this concert or in a concert organised in this way as you are on the street. But there's a lot of sceptics who watched it in Spain and said it made them pretty uncomfortable given the level of restrictions, and that really, although they would like to get back to life as normal, they didn't see themselves going for a concert like this.
Journalist Sarah Morris from Today with Claire Byrne. The Samaritans, someone to just talk to, someone to listen to you and share your thoughts when you're going through the wars or just very lonely. On the Ryan Tuberty Show, Aileen Spitera, the Deputy Director of Samaritans Ireland, spoke about the pandemic of loneliness, the importance of those calls and how she became a volunteer herself.
Where we need to go with you is London, because in some ways you are the essence of what the Samaritans experience is all about. Could you take us to 80s London and maybe describe your haircut?
Well, it probably would be better than it is now.
says Ireland.
Well, I suppose when I left university in the 80s, 1983, I went to Canada to do a master's and then went to London because, of course, like everybody else, there was nothing in Ireland. And also, I was absolutely over the moon to go to London. It was sort of the place to be. Half my class were there. But what I noticed fairly quickly was on a Sunday morning, people were either recovering from the night before or they were washing their cars. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not obviously not saying every English person does that. But, you know, coming from Ireland, where everyone goes to Mass and went to Mass in the 80s and the 90s at that time, I thought, God, there must be more to life. Everyone was buying bigger houses and bigger cars. And I just didn't come from that sort of a background. My parents always said to me, you know, be satisfied with what you have. Try and be as happy as you can with what you have, that sort of thing.
Sure.
So a friend of mine was doing Samaritans. I had no idea what it was all about other than it helped people, and I thought, I'll go along to an information evening. Now, I was 22, and when I heard what they did, I thought, well, they won't have me because I've no life experience for that. But actually, what they do and what we still do is listen. Mm-hmm. And you don't need any experience for that. You just need to learn how to listen properly.
Do you remember any of the early calls? At 22, yeah.
Same as we're having now, I think. There hasn't been a massive change. Probably a little bit more then about people coming out as gay, probably not feeling accepted in society. So that has probably lessened a little bit, or maybe there are other organisations. But huge amount of people talking about relationships, and nowadays, I suppose, in the last year, a huge amount of people talking about feeling isolated and lonely.
I know. I mean, I don't know, but I understand what you mean. I often wonder about, you know, we have obviously the different organisations that can take a call from somebody, say, in an abusive relationship, and domestic violence relationship, which if you give it any moment in your day to think about it, how horrific it must be, and throw in a pandemic, obviously. Would you have taken calls like that? And how do you handle? I mean, listening is great, but what if somebody's saying, what do I do?
Well, actually, it's funny because I was only thinking about, because obviously we can't talk about individual calls because of the importance of confidentiality to Samaritans. But I remember talking to someone years ago who was in an abusive relationship. She knew she was in an abusive relationship, and I knew, but I was very young at the time, and I have to say, going on in my head was, for God's sake, would you get out of that? But really what she wanted to talk about was the fact that she still loved him. And that was what she rang about, because she was horrified because she still loved him. She couldn't understand how she did. And we had a very long call about her feelings. And, of course, that's where Samaritans are at our best, really, to be honest, is trying to help people sort out how they're feeling, what they want to do with those feelings, but mostly exploring them, because generally life doesn't allow people that sort of time and space to talk about that. And that's, I think, where Samaritans are best, you know. So, and just talking about how you feel really can help. And it sounds crazy because people say, oh, you just listen. And you think, no, we don't just listen. We listen, and we listen very carefully. And there's a big difference. You know?
Listening is not as easy as it sounds.
No, it can be very tiring. You know, if you do 3.5 hours And particularly, I think, at the moment, because maybe Samaritan Volunteers' resilience may be down a little bit as well. It can take a lot out of you. But we have a fantastic support system, so we look after each other.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm sorry, I'm going to bounce back a bit to the call about the woman in the domestic violence situation who says she still loves her, husband or her partner. I think that among all the difficult points for, those who are, who aren't in a domestic violence situation, one of the things they find it hardest to understand is how the person who has been beaten up emotionally or physically remains in love with the perpetrator of that of that cruelty.
It's very sad, really, isn't it?
Oh, it's desperate.
And I don't pretend to understand that. And I suppose, thankfully, that's one of the reasons I do Samaritans. I don't need to understand, and I don't need to be an expert in any of these things, because I'm there to, help her talk about that. And because we don't give advice, I mean, in some ways it's a relief. It's very liberating, because we don't give advice. We can then spend all the time she needed or anybody else needs to talk about their feelings. And there are other organisations out there who are experts in all those different fields. And what Samaritans are experts in really is listening.
And Aileen spoke about the pandemic and the feelings of loneliness and isolation.
We have lots of lonely and isolated people, elderly people, but also very young people, students, university students in particular, who are, I would say, lonely in the bedrooms of their homes rather than in student shares, you know, in the big cities and whatever, which is what they would have been planning for. You have a lot of people apologising, particularly older people, saying, oh, I'm really sorry now for taking up your time. I know there are people much worse off than me. We're incredible that way in Ireland, really.
Yes.
You know, we spent half the time apologising for ringing. And then you realise this person hasn't spoken to anybody for 24 hours. Like, she hasn't seen anybody, she hasn't spoken to anybody. And that's not uncommon, you know, because families are worried that they're going to pass on the virus. There are people who are afraid to go out and meet their friends or even go out for a walk, and they're inside. And that's terrible. Now, I suppose the good thing is they've picked up the phone. And, you know, I'd hate to sort of be portraying a gloom and doom, because a lot of people, once they've spoken to us, do feel a lot better. So in many respects, picking up the phone is a huge sign of strength, that they're doing something about how they feel. And it makes a huge difference, and people say, you know, I don't want to take up any more of your time now. I'll go because I feel a lot better. And you think, well, that's as good as it can get, really, you know.
I've said it before, I say it again. Any one of us, including myself, can often be alone and not lonely.
Yeah.
And I wonder, could you help me in defining what loneliness looks like, in the sense that there could be some people listening today going, I'm never going to call the Samaritans because that's for lonely people. And I think I'm lonely, but I'm not sure. I'd love to talk to somebody, but it's not the Samaritans because I'm not that bad. You know, could you put a shape on that for me?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, it's amazing the amount of people say, well, I never thought I'd be the type of person who'd ring Samaritans.
Exactly.
The person who rings Samaritans is someone like me, and maybe someone like you, Ryan, ordinary people with ordinary lives whose lives have been turned upside down by in the last year. So it's difficulty. So, I mean, the worst case scenarios are people who can't get out of bed in the morning because they're just, they're so bored and they're so isolated that there's nothing to get up for.
Yeah.
But there are people who are not that bad and just have recognised that they need to talk to somebody. They've no human contact. And maybe we underestimate how important, well, I don't think we do anymore in the last year, but human companionship is really what most human beings run on. Well, I certainly do anyway. Now, I love time to myself, and I like to, you know, head out for a walk or be in the garden, but I know there's somebody there when I come home, or there's somebody. And if that was removed, which it can be quite easily in these circumstances, very quickly, you know, I think for the first 24 hours you'd say, oh God, the peace and quiet is lovely. But if you've nothing, if you've nobody to share it with, and people do ring their families and things like that, but they also don't want to burden their families. And I think Samaritans can carry that burden with them, even if it's for a little while, and ease the load for a small bit. But the people ringing us are ordinary people, always, not just during COVID. That's the beauty of Samaritans. You know, there's nothing really different between the people who call us and the people who are answering the phone, except that we're well-trained to answer the calls, I suppose.
And Ryan spoke about saying hello to someone you think might be lonely.
I was off for a few days, Aileen, and as I was walking around the place, I noticed a familiar sight became apparent to me, which was women of a certain vintage, older, on their own, on a bench, be at a bus stop bench or near a park or near the sea or whatever it might be, eating an ice cream, reading a book or drinking a cup of coffee, very much on their own.
Yeah.
And here's what struck me. Two things. One, is it any of my business to go up and say, how are you getting on today? And are you well? And to try and make them feel less alone? Or, in other words, part of me had catastrophized these people and living alone and coming out just to try and meet somebody, and yet they're still just eating their ice cream on their own. Or do you walk by and say, none of your business?
Well, I mean, what's the worst that can happen if you walk by and say hello? They tell you to...
That's a great answer.
You know,
that'll do
I mean,
me.
I think you could make the difference to somebody's life. It actually reminds me of when I was in London, when I got on the tube first.
Yeah.
I mean, in the 80s, you get on a bus and you'd say hello to everyone. And I got on the tube and I went, hello, hello. And you could feel people move away. And I remember thinking, God, that's very sad. I mean, obviously a big city. But, and a friend of mine's husband, who was an only child, who was English, married someone from Dublin. And he got to the bus stop. And he said by the time he got into town, he was exhausted from the amount of people talking to him. Which had never happened in London, you know, because people keep their space. I think it's very important for us all to even just say hello to somebody can make a difference. You know?
I agree. We shouldn't lose that. I think in Ireland we're hard on ourselves, but we're better than we think.
Oh, we are. Most certainly we are. Yeah. We love the old chat, you know.
Oh, yeah. The chin wag.
The chin wag, exactly. You know, and I suppose, you know, Samaritans, we're inclined to, it's funny, we do this thing on the 21st of December for the last number of years where we go out in Cork, we go out onto the streets just to remind people we're there over the Christmas period when, you know, other support services might not be as readily available. And often people say, sure, you're like the fabric, in you're part of the fabric of society, you know. And I was thinking, yeah, and why don't... You don't hear about Samaritans that much. And I was talking to someone about that, and they were saying it's because it reflects the people who do it. A lot of Samaritan volunteers don't like to tell people they're volunteering because it's a sort of a private thing, and the conversations you have with people, intimate can be misconstrued in the wrong way, but people are telling you some of their deepest thoughts. So we don't tend to shout it from the rooftops yet. We're 60, almost 60 years in Ireland. Belfast will be celebrating 60 years this year, and Dublin was 50 years last year. So we've been around a very long time. And I suppose I have the opportunity now to say thanks to the amazing volunteers. For example, we've missed a lot of them in the last few in months because some of them have been cocooning. And I had a call from one of the volunteers the other day who's in her 80s, and she said, I've had my second dose. Yeah. I'm booking duties for April. She was so excited to be coming back.
Isn't that gorgeous?
Just think, that's what Samaritan volunteers are about, really. Now, you know, I don't want to be blowing my own trumpet, but, like, they are remarkable people, really.
Aileen Spiterra, and you can contact the Samaritans on free phone 116 123, or you can email joe@samaritans.ie. And on Today with Claire Byrne, The Who's Dr. David Nabarro on the predicted easing of restrictions in Ireland.
Well, certainly everybody needs to be careful. And I was thinking this morning, preparing for this interview, what do I mean by being careful? And the answer is, I mean just thinking at all times about whether or not we're making it easy for the virus to come along and get us and make us sick. And so it's what steps can we take to just hold the virus back? And that's where the distance that we maintain from other people really does matter. And going up close because we love somebody, or going up close because we're hard of hearing, or going up close because we're dealing with a piece of detail, we're dealing with a pattern and we want to try to get it right. All that going up close stuff, although it might seem to be perfectly harmless, that's where we get the infection. And that's why we've got to keep the masks on, and we've also got to keep the hygiene up, and we've got to keep isolating. But most importantly, it is being a bit thoughtful before we get up close. It doesn't feel natural, but that's what we've got to do, Claire.
Because I'm sure you're aware, you know, non-essential retail is closed here. Construction in the main is closed, trying to get the schools back open. There are very stringent restrictions still, and it doesn't seem, going back to what we were saying saying earlier about living with COVID, we're not quite there yet in this country.
Not yet, no, not yet. But, you know, small steps with the direction in mind is what we have to do. We have to feel our way, and if something goes wrong, we have to be ready to go back. Just the thing I would say to everybody, and Claire, you connect with so many people through your show, so I want to say it very directly now, it is this. We might be bored of the virus, but the virus is not bored of us. Because the virus is single-minded. It just wants to multiply and spread. And so we're bored because it's messing up our lives. But just remember that the virus thrives on us letting down our defences. That's when the virus actually starts to spread. And that's what we've got to look out for. So I'm going to say to everybody in Ireland, hold on, keep it up. You've done great. But don't stop now just because it's coming up to the summer and everybody wants to get out and have fun. Please go on treating with this virus with respect, because it's horrible.
As more of our vulnerable become vaccinated, David, does it follow then that daily case numbers become less relevant because we're mitigating against serious illness and death?
Absolutely. Daily case numbers are not the primary variable we need to look at. It's who's getting ill, where they're getting ill, and how they're getting cared for. So, for example, if the pattern of illness shifts and we've got more and more younger people getting ill, that probably means the vaccine is protecting older people and younger people are now kind of becoming the more dominant community. Where they're getting ill, we've got to keep a lookout for whether there are particular places in the community, like residential care or like particular kinds of factories, where there is a higher risk. And lastly, most importantly, is what's happening to them when they get diagnosed. Are they getting the treatment they need? And are they actually responding to that treatment? These are the kind of pieces of information that the authorities will be looking at. They'll be looking at it county by county and then for the country as a whole. But that's what it takes. It's looking at the capacity to respond that becomes the central feature of where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. And what about a vaccine bonus for those who have had their two shots?
Well, it's going to be quite a big bonus. What will happen over time is that people who've had their two shots will find themselves getting sort of a bypass entry into venues. They will find themselves more easily able to travel. And they might find themselves also more welcome in certain countries than others. And that's, unfortunately, for me, a reality. I had hoped that we weren't going to end up where vaccine status was going to make a big difference, but I think it will, at least at the beginning. What I'm really hopeful for in the longer term is that we'll move beyond where the people who got vaccine certificates, and we'll be able to say, you come from Ireland? You're welcome, because Ireland is a country that takes this virus seriously and has got really good defence mechanisms in place. So we'll let you in because you come from Ireland, not because you've got a piece of paper or something like that. That's what I hope it'll get to in the end.
Dr. David Nabarro from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Lifeline. This is a very difficult story to listen to. Micheál Campbell called Joe to talk about the murder of his only daughter, Kira, by her ex-boyfriend, Gordon Molloy. Micheál doesn't think Molloy should ever be released from prison.
No. Kira was murdered, and our only daughter, child, was murdered on the 12th of November, 2007.
Okay.
In a premeditated murder. If there's any little ears listening there,
okay,
maybe they should go to the next room.
Okay. Thanks for that.
He, he stabbed her at least 28 times in a premeditated murder. He had broken into her house. He lay in wait for our daughter coming home from a night out. And he did what he did. And then he attempted to have sex with her dead corpse. With her corpse.
So he got a Malloy got a life sentence.
Malloy got a life sentence, and I'll never forget the time we were leaving the courthouse, and our liaison officer was driving. Frank Stevenson is our liaison officer, and he was driving us back from the courthouse. And I said to my wife, I said, "Well, that's that part over." And Frank turned around and looked at us, and he goes, "Life doesn't mean life." Not in this country. And he says, he can apply for parole after 7 years. And I remember us looking at each other after all we'd been through, all the hurt, the pain, and the heartache, and we couldn't believe that at the time, you know? And like Malloy was sentenced in July 2009. This is still 2021. Like, it's only 12 years into a life sentence. And he's been up for parole twice, and we had been told he's been up for, like, we've been told to prepare for three times, like.
And the other element of it is, Michal, that Malloy had been released early from prison when he murdered your daughter.
Yeah,
he was doing.
Yeah, I was just going to refer to your program last week. When you were talking about parole and people getting out and day visits. I was on with you last year, Joe, about the day visits, and we got great support. And Malloy was actually refused his second day visit out after the show.
I remember
But Malloy was up for a charge in Carlo Court, the local courthouse, and he was found guilty of ABH. He attacked a person with a snooker ball or a pool ball and a sock, and was found guilty of what he did. And the local court let him out on surety of, I think it was 2,000 or 5,000 euro. I can't be exactly sure of that. But so he was let out pending what sentence he would get. And that's when he murdered our daughter. Oh, he was actually out. That's, you know, he was out on bail, which is, and it's like, it's an equivalent of a parole, isn't it? Really, it's the same thing. You're out when you shouldn't be out. So, like, in our eyes, like, Ciara would still be alive if Malloy had been put in prison that time.
And he had threatened Ciara before, hadn't he?
He had threatened Ciara before, he had followed her, he'd sat outside her house in the car, playing music, drinking, he'd followed her, but it's like, you know, Ciara had gone back to college in St. Catharines in Carlo, and she'd Jamie, our grandson, her son, had started primary school in Carlo. It's just, you know, everything was going right for her again. She'd got rid of Malloy, but he followed her everywhere she went, and he threatened her in public. And you know, her friends stood up in court to witness what he had said to her in public, you know. Okay. And this is the lad who then, choose our system, can apply for parole three times so far. Now, last time was last May, and he was refused again, thank God. But, you know, the letter did state that, you know, that is, you know, it's nearly his right to apply again within 2 years.
And were the family asked to make a submission?
We have up to date with made at least three submissions, at least three times, and those submissions Malloy can see.
Yeah,
he can see everything we send in. Anything we have to say, he sees it, his side, as he was able to see it.
Yeah.
But we don't, you know, we can't see anything that's happening on the inside. On his case, you know.
And little Jamie obviously is what would he be now? 20, 19?
Oh, 20? He's 18, Joe.
18.
He's just turned 18 last November,
And, He went through an awful lot as well. He's still going through, having.
He's still going through it day by day, Joe. Yeah, you know, he lives here with his mammo and his daddo when he should be living with his mommy.
Micheál Campbell on the live line with Joe Duffy. Now, time to cringe. Some of those old TV shows that sound tone deaf now, and the nuance of comedy in an era of cancel culture. Journalists Jen Gannon and Paul Whittington were talking to Claire in the morning, so let's get the ball rolling with a bit of Fawlty Towers.
They're not thinkers. I see it with Sybil every day.
I do wish I could remember her name. She's still got my wallet.
As I was saying, no capacity for logical thought.
Who?
Women.
Oh, yes. I thought you meant Indians.
No. Wasn't it Oscar Wilde who said they have minds like Swiss cheese?
What do you mean, hard?
No, full of holes.
Indians?
No, women.
Paul, I can still smile at that, rightly or wrongly, because he was intentionally on PC. We weren't laughing with him, you're laughing at him, right?
I agree entirely, Claire. When the BBC and the RT Player show that series now, they have a disclaimer in case anybody gets offended, as everybody is so prone to do now. But I think the reason Fawlty Towers still works is because Basil wasn't in on the joke. He was the joke. He was a misogynist. He was probably a racist. And he was always giving out about his wife. But if you look at Sybil, she was actually a much more charming and competent person than him. He only thought that she was a dragon in his head. So I think that can absolutely be enjoyed with caveats. The Germans do turn up in that episode, actually, which would be offensive to it. But I think once the key thing is that he is the joke.
Jen, to come to you on this, this issue arose about a week ago on the programme when we were talking about showing Ghostbusters to our children. And I found it quite breathtaking that there was a lot of sexism, you know, kind of ogling over the secretary and so on, that I'm not sure I wanted my children to see. But do we have to be careful where we're drawing our lines here?
I think that, you know, people change, tastes change, and society changes. And, you know, nobody's still sitting around mourning the loss of Jim Davidson on primetime TV or anything. And comedy is a very visceral medium, and it can age quickly and badly, as we know. And a lot of shows are products of their time. But I think the problem is there's a strand of thinking, mostly done by men, I have to say, on social media, that women don't get comedy or just want everything to be unfunny or PC. And they're wrong. I don't think, you know, great modern comedy is tame in any way, shape or form. You know, comedy is always based on friction. It has to be tension, and there has to be a layer of cruelty to it. And modern comedy, I don't think, avoids that in any way whatsoever. If you look at something like Fleabag or Catastrophe or Nighty Night or The Thick of It or Insecure, you can't say that these are just pleasant PC shows. They're, you know, dark and demanding and irreverent. But what we have to be careful of is that we don't want to be reductive and we don't want to be lazy. And I think the more stories that we get from the widest possible viewpoints on TV, the better TV will be.
Jen Gannon from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.